you'd all take your seats, we're ready to proceed with our post-launch conference. We have a request to turn up the audio, if you will, please. I'd like to introduce to you Major General Sam Phillips, who is the Apollo Program Manager. We'll hold just for a moment till everybody gets settled. We're trying to bring it up as loud as we can.
Let us speak right into that, I think, yep. Sam, when we're ready to proceed. Let's let him move it.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. There isn't, you know, I could start off, I guess, on several notes. One of which is that there isn't really very much I can say because we told it all to you in advance, and that's the way it went. I would like to say that Dr. Debus and Dr. Gilruth and Dr. Von Braun, I asked them if they'd come out with me. Werner said he's not taking congratulations until after the second burn. The launch vehicle did the major part of its job in getting the largest payload that I believe has ever been put in orbit. It's something over 285,000 pounds that just passed over Carnarvon, be over the States here in something like another 30 minutes. The launch vehicle has a very major part of its job left to do, namely to add the velocity for a translunar injection burn, to add the energy for that portion of its flight. The instrument unit and S-4B stage, which are in orbit with the spacecraft, are performing well. The checks as they've gone over the ground stations have indicated the proper stabilization and control. Telemetry's fine. Everything's in go condition in the remaining upper part of the launch vehicle. The spacecraft is completely in go condition and performing exactly as it should. So as I say, Werner says he's not going to take congratulations until after his launch vehicle has finished his job, which it won't have done until something like 3.5 hours after liftoff. Dr. Debus, who did such a great job in building and leading the organization here at KSC, which put this vehicle together, checked it out, and directed the launch, felt obliged to immediately go out to the launch site where certainly some damage was done to the mobile launcher. That's not entirely unexpected. That was a tremendous amount of energy that passed by that tower during the liftoff. There were some fires on some of the swing arms and on some parts of the tower, and he's anxious to go out there along with the fire crews and have a look at it so he can start to figure out how much refurbishment is needed to get it ready for the next vehicle to be built on it. And Dr. Gilruth reminds me that his spacecraft has still got something over 8 hours of mission before we expect to recover it in the Pacific Ocean. The orbital parameters, since I left the Launch Control Center before the tracking had really stabilized out to get orbital figures that I will consider don't have some noise in them. The initial report from the first set of tracking data said it was 100 by 100, and that's, of course, what it was designed to be. Just before I left, they gave me some figures which indicate the orbital parameters at 99.5 and 103.2. I wouldn't take either set of those figures yet as without some noise. I think they still have some noise in them. We had in our plan to for the Air Force recovery forces here in the Atlantic to see if they could recover the first stage after it had done its job and come back in. The report that we have is that it broke up during reentry, coming back from its altitude, that the pieces they've observed in the water are no larger than about 2 feet square. So it appears that we're not going to have a recovered S1C stage to do any evaluation of, and I didn't really expect we would. The S2 stage carried two camera cassettes, the purpose of which was to take photography of the staging maneuver, and then several seconds after the skirt was dropped off the S2, the camera pods were ejected. The report I have is that cassette number one has been located by electronic direction finding. Cassette number two has been visually sighted, still in the water, and maybe by now they've got either or both of those. There'll be some valuable photography of the staging maneuver that I think will contribute to the solidity of the development of this launch vehicle. I think this operation so far, and I do want to reemphasize again that as far as the Apollo 4 mission is concerned, there's about 8 hours left, and we're by no means in any position to consider this mission a success nor complete in any sense. But I think what we've seen this morning demonstrates several things. One of the most important, I think, it demonstrates is the value of the countdown demonstration test, which took us between 2 and 3 weeks to accomplish here a few weeks ago. That was a test, the purpose of which was to demonstrate both people and equipment, and to perfect both people and equipment. That it accomplished its job was certainly demonstrated by an on-time launch of this tremendous big space vehicle from this tremendously large and complex set of ground servicing and control equipment. I think it demonstrated another thing that I think may be even more important to the progress of Apollo in getting to the moon than some of the technical returns that we have already gotten and will still get from the Apollo 4 mission. And that's the power of a group of good people. This was, I believe, the most powerful rocket, perhaps the most powerful machine in terms of energy per second that's ever performed. And you could almost feel the power of the launch team during the night and on through the early morning hours and the last minutes and seconds of that countdown. I've been through a lot of countdowns of rockets. I've been in various positions in various launch operations over the years, and I was tremendously impressed with the smooth teamwork that this combined government, multi-industry team put together. It was smooth, it was professional, it was competent, it was perfect in every respect. It was a powerful operation. You could almost feel the will with which it was being carried out. Now, I think that's important to the progress of Apollo, as I said, perhaps even more so than some of the technical returns we'll get from this mission. I'll characterize it this way: Apollo is on the way to the moon. We are preparing two additional flights here at the present time, and I think we'll be moving out with a good, solid operation. And this mission certainly gets us on that path. I think with those comments about what has been done so far and what remains, I'd attempt to answer any questions you may have.
Yeah. Okay, right down here in the first row. Would you identify yourself, please, for transcript purposes?
Art Hill, the Houston Chronicle. General, could you give us something of the reaction in the control center there as the rocket lifted off? Was there cheering? What happened? What did they do?
Yeah, there was a chair, as a matter of fact. You know, it's interesting that in the early years of rockets, was my observation that at the moment of liftoff, the whole blockhouse would stand and cheer and so on. After I saw that once, I cautioned people that the job of a launch team is by no means finished at the moment of liftoff, because there's a tremendous amount of securing of the many systems that got that thing off that has to be done just as carefully as getting it off. So in these times, you don't see a whole launch team stand up and run around shaking hands and cheering. But this launch team this morning, without rising from their consoles, let out a little cheer, and I thought it was well deserved. I might want to add one other point. I know you got shaken up a little bit out here, and I understand there was a perhaps a little bit of roof fell in someplace. The launch control center shook too, and I called that the operational shakedown. We were kind of covered with plaster dust, which shook out of the concrete structure. Back up there.
Albert Sailstead, Baltimore Sun. There was a good deal of talk about the gusts of wind that might affect the launch, and I was wondering if the gusts were very high at the time of launch and if there was any discernible effect upon the rocket.
The winds diminished in the morning hours and were running in the region of 15, less than 20. They were running less than 20 knots at the time of launch. Now, as far as discernible effect, from the standpoint of observation and the quick look at data that's flowing at the time, no discernible effect. However, that vehicle and also the launch facilities were very heavily instrumented for obvious reasons, and after some number of days of data reduction and analysis, we'll know a lot about the structural effects at the hold down release.
Right up there? Right where you are, Al. Take that, all right, go ahead. We'll take the three of you in there.
Jim Slade, Westinghouse Broadcasting. Two questions, General. Do you have any, can you give us the specific areas of pad damage? And number two, the second stage engine out reading, did you get it here as well as in Houston? And where was the fault? Do you know yet?
Well, first question on pad damage, I don't have any report yet. We were able to observe both visually by binoculars and from the operational television in various positions on the launch structure that there were some fires burning. I would assume that they were in wire insulation and perhaps in I just don't know yet how much damage was done. I would emphasize that we expected the mobile launcher to sustain damage in the launch. In order to design it so that it wouldn't expect any damage, would have been a virtually preposterous thing to have done. So we contemplate damage. Now, whether we had more or less than was contemplated, we'll have to wait until people can get out there and make an inspection. Now, on your question about an S2 engine, I don't understand the question because it was nominal performance.
I think Paul Haney announced indications of an engine out and then explained that there was a telemetry dropout. I don't remember. Oh. I don't think we received this information.
Well, let me say this, that I was listening on the flight control loop where they were announcing the readout of instrumentation aboard, and there was no anomalous performance in any of the stages. There was, for a few minutes here in this blockhouse, a display on one panel which was manually controlled from the blockhouse here, which indicated that the S4B stage had cut off, and it before it should, but that was erroneous. And from the intercom loop that I was listening to, all the way through orbital insertion, the engine and stage performance was right on the money.
Jules?
Jules Bergman, ABC News. General Phillips, does this put Apollo back on the track, do you think? And what are your feelings about our getting to the moon before 1970 after this morning's success?
This mission, as I said before, still has almost 8 hours to fly. And I won't regard it as a complete success until then. A tremendous portion of its objectives have already been achieved. This mission will do a lot to get the whole Apollo team moving on a positive course. It'll do a lot for the progress in coming months of the Apollo program. Yesterday, I would have said that I think we have reasonably good chance of accomplishing a lunar landing before the end of 1969. Today, I think that reasonably good chance is maybe a notch above reasonably good.
This gentleman right here.
Adam Powell, Public Broadcast Laboratory. Yesterday, General Phillips, you said that if we are very successful with 501 and 502 and require no additional data, we will then use 503 for manned flight. At this point in the mission, it would seem that 501 has been very successful. And so my question is this. If 503 is given a green light for a manned mission, would this not bypass the Saturn 1, low Earth orbit manned missions in general, and the 205 mission in particular, since 205 follows 503 in the latest schedule out of Dr. Mueller's office? If so, would the Shiraz crew be a possible or a probable choice for this mission? And if not, what would be the function of delaying 503 until after 205?
We will fly the 101 block, which is the first Block 2 spacecraft, on the uprated Saturn 1 launch vehicle 205, regardless of the outcome of missions 501 and 502, which officially are Apollo 4 and Apollo 6. The outcome of this mission will not change that decision. The first part of your question, there was discussion in yesterday's conference of what we might do in the event of very good performance and attainment of objectives in Apollo 4 and 6, insofar as 503 is concerned. I think that Dr. Siemens made it eminently clear that our schedules contemplate and call for flying 501, 2, and 3 as unmanned flights, and that his statement indicates that we are postured and prepared to capitalize on success if the total situation warrants. Now, I don't really know how to develop it much further, but we do intend to fly our first manned mission on the Saturn 1B.
Go ahead, Dick.
Dick Lewis, Chicago Sun-Times. One point I'm not quite clear on, General. Was orbital insertion nominal, or was it slightly off?
From the data that I was listening to, it was nominal. And that will be confirmed, incidentally, over the flight director reporting out of Houston.
Go ahead, Carl.
Considering what we
would you identify yourself, please, Carl?
Carl Abraham of the Philadelphia Bulletin. Considering what we saw out there a little over an hour ago, this must easily rank as the most modest post-launch press conference of a first-time-out vehicle that's ever been held. I don't mean to be in any way disrespectful, but are there any plans for us to be able to talk to people who were directly involved with the design of these various stages and with the project management at various centers and things of this sort? I'd like to know what Dr. Von Braun's reaction was when that S1C burned the way it did and went up. When are we going to find that out?
The plans, as I think they were announced previously, call for the post-launch report to be given in the manner that I'm giving it. There is not at the present time a plan for such conference as you have described. I'll refer that question to our public information expert.
Okay, we'll take it as your request. We'll try to get the availability of the people, and we'll make an announcement to you. Is that satisfactory? I'll come back to you, gentlemen. We've had a couple of hands that are getting a little sore over there. Let's take these two gentlemen over here, then we'll come back across.
Art Lord, NBC News. General Phillips, you said there was cheering, or a slight cheer, I believe you put it, right after liftoff. What was your own personal reaction when that huge beast cleared the tower?
I was impressed.
This gentleman right here.
John Wilhelm Time. General, was there any subsystem or element prior to launch this morning that was malfunctioning and overridden?
None of consequence. For a period in the early morning, there was one of two redundant ground units that provide cooling to the spacecraft while it's on the pad was not operating. It was brought back into operation. As I say, it was one of two redundant units, and the one that continued to operate provided the necessary cooling. There was also a malfunction of one of two redundant pumps in the liquid nitrogen part of the ground system, which took about 2 hours to make the repairs so that the backup pump was back in operation. There were no problems on the vehicle that had me concerned during the night.
We have any more questions? Okay, way over here with Mary Bubb. Mark Bloom, it's right in front of Mark. Go ahead and we'll take Mary.
Mark Bloom, New York Daily News. General Phillips, I don't think we ever heard the exact time of liftoff. Do you have it?
The exact time of liftoff, as recorded on our instruments, was 7000.
Go ahead, Mary. Bringing it up. Go ahead, try it now.
Mary Bubb, Fairchild Publications. General Phillips, from the viewpoint of American technology and industry, what do you consider the significance of this flight?
Well, it certainly is demonstrating the results of a tremendously complex development of electronics, of hydraulics and cryogenics and pneumatics and massive structures. I think it is a tremendous step in the application of technology. I'm not sure whether that's a satisfactory answer, but it's about the best I can do with it right now.
Let's take this gentleman down here in this row. Then your colleagues in Houston have some questions. We'll go there to take several questions from them. General Phillips does have to return in about 10 minutes, so I'm afraid we're going to have to wind up here shortly. This gentleman in the front row, please.
This is Mr. Richards in the Oregon in Portland. General Phillips, would you call this a perfect launch, the actual launch that we saw? Was there any flaw in the launch and the performance of the first stage, the S1C?
This was a perfect launch and a perfect performance of a launch vehicle up through the orbital insertion.
Okay, we'll now go to Houston to take some questions, please.
Ralph Schenkel, KMSC. What are the weather conditions now and predicted conditions for recovery in the Pacific area?
The weather in the Pacific in the recovery area is somewhat rough. There's a front lying nearly along the flight path. It wasn't possible to predict accurately its course.
That's what was earlier. I don't know the number. Recovery went.
The winds were predicted to be in the region of 25 knots, wave heights of the order of 8 feet, and ceilings in the frontal area and behind the front down around 1,500 feet, and in some cases below in rain showers. The weather in the recovery area is going to give some problem. This was very carefully considered in the decision to go ahead with the launch, considering the experience with our guidance system, our guidance accuracy, the many tests that we've run, and so far as our spacecraft structural systems are concerned, and I'm confident that we will in fact recover this spacecraft without undue difficulty, but there will be some challenge for the recovery forces in dealing with the weather out in the Pacific.
Louis Alexander, the National Observer. General Phillips, would you estimate how long you could hear the noise after launch, and could you describe it?
Well, the noise was described in advance to be of the level of 120 decibels, and I guess quite a few of us learn more about what 120 decibels sounds like. It's loud, it's thundering. The vibration certainly could be felt coming through the ground, and the vibration of the air also could be felt. The duration, I was listening to a lot of things, and I'd say that the sound was I could hear it, I believe, up through most of the first stage burn.
Jeff Thompson, KMSC Radio. General Phillips, we have not received much information thus far on the status of the Apollo spacecraft itself. Did you have anything on the loop you were listening on when you left the center?
When I left the Launch Control Center, the S-4B instrument unit and spacecraft had passed over the Bermuda, Canary tracking stations. They confirmed that the stabilization and control was functioning properly, and all the systems were in go condition. So at the time I left the Launch Control Center, everything was go and working as it should be.
Charlie King says both case sets have been recovered.
I understand both that the Air Force recovery people here have recovered both of our camera cassettes that were ejected from the S-2 stage.
Are there any further questions from Houston? At this point, then, we will complete the conference. Well, all right, Jules, we'll take one from you. And we'll take one over here, and I'm afraid that'll be it.
General Phillips, if 501 continues to be as great a success as it has been, if the second S-4B burn on the SPS systems work as well as they may, will 502 still be a complete repeat of 501, or will you change the mission?
Well, 502 will fly as planned under the conditions of your question. And 502 is a sister ship of this one. The mission is nearly identical. The main difference in the spacecraft is that 502 carries the new Block 2 hatch in this Block 2 heat shield. Otherwise, the vehicles are sister ships, identical. We will fly 502 as planned under the conditions of your question.
This lady right here for the final question, Lo.
Antines Le Figaro. I would like to know what was the temperature at the pad at the moment of the shot.
The ambient air temperature here?
I think she means...
You know, the temperature of the flames.
Oh. Gee, we'll have to look that up for you and get you an answer. I'm sorry, I don't know.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. We'll keep you posted.